All right, go.
It is a center for higher learning. It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls. This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos. Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
Dear, that was anonymous. Holy shit, I don't know how we're going to live up to an introduction like that. I mean, that might sound like we're going to peel open your listeners' heads like an orange and puke, you know, the Necronomicon down over their pineal glands.
Oh my God.
And welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, that's Keeper Dan, who's having a small fit. John is nowhere to be seen.
What?
No, he's here. I'm sorry. You're really here. I apologize.
Yes.
While I was having my appendicitis, he was having a birth or something.
That's right.
Was having a birth.
It burst forth from my chest. Yes.
He was an audience member to a birth.
That's yeah. Right.
A very close audience member.
Like, oh my God, get the doctor, I see the head.
That's what you want to get.
It's like, yeah, I would hope the doctor would already be there by that point, but...
She had taken a little break because it was taking a while.
Ah. That's awesome.
It's like, oh my God, there it is, go get the doc.
Alert.
I'm sorry, she's in the middle of the seventh fairway. You're going to have to wait.
That actually happened to us. It was quite pleasant. The nurses, it turns out the nurses can deliver without much problem whatsoever.
And yet you still receive a bill from the doctor.
Mm. Oh, yes. A very large one, too.
All right. Well, enough of these squalling infants and on to the podcast.
Yes. Hello, and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, Episode 20. The podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
I'm Keeper John. Welcome, everyone, as if you didn't know, I was already here.
Yep.
Yeah, and I'm Keeper Murph. Glad to have you here.
And I'm Keeper Chad. Wagon of Glafatagan.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how he does that. In episode 20, we're foregoing our usual visit to the Bestiary and Special Collections because...
Because the main topic of our show, we have special guest Mr. Adam Scott Glancy, president of Pagan Publishing. Yay!
What's wrong with the Bestiary and the special Collections? That sounds marvelous.
We'll come back next episode.
Because we wanted to have more time to be able to talk with you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you don't worry, you will. Because if anyone who's ever interviewed me has learned, you're going to get more material than you know what to do with.
Exactly. That's why we removed those segments.
which reminds me, did anybody, who did I send that Bumps in the Night to, and did you get it?
Yes, I did.
Excellent.
Thank you very, very much. It's beautiful.
So. All right, so where do we delve in first?
Well, we're going to start things off with the news section of the show, which we call the Campus Crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
All right. Campus Crier is the school paper, and we're going to go through any feedback and news. And first off, our little fundraiser to help out with server costs and equipment died at 77%.
Wah, wah, wah.
Yeah, next time we'll plan that better and start it on a show instead of in the middle of a break like an idiot that I am.
Oh, well.
Yeah, next time. We'll.
We had several people who pitched with that.
Which service did you guys use?
Crowd
Tilt? We used a service called Crowd Tilt because it doesn't force you to make like stretch goals and stuff like that. It's just they give you money, you hit goal, you get money. So
yeah.
Got it.
We didn't have anything set to give as incentives.
Yeah. Well, maybe next time. Maybe we'll have to work for it next time.
We've got thoughts of that kind of thing, yeah.
All right.
Worst case scenario, you got four keepers here, and people paid good money to have me run games for him.
Yeah, but you're famous.
Yes. Exactly.
I'm not even internet famous. That's not even a thing.
Your name is inside of books, dude. A lot of books.
They're mostly books published. So where was the achievement in that?
Holy hell, is that the secret?
But go
and try and buy one of those self-published books on eBay and tell me how much it costs.
I gotta admit, that always annoys me, especially when people are throwing the books around on eBay, and I still got a warehouse full of them. Why are you paying
$135 for the original Delta Green?
You should stress them and then sell them on eBay.
There you go, for a 30% profit.
Break the binding.
Well, very soon we will have some decent copies up on, we will have some non-scanned PDFs up on One Bookshelf and DriveThruRPG, so you can get a very nice print-on-demand copy from them.
Nice.
That's what I've been waiting for, honestly, a non-scanned copy.
Yeah, because then you can search, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. Once that happens, once we've got those done, hooray! But again, it's a matter of finding layout people who will work for paltry sums to convert these crappy old PageMaker files into something modern. And right now, the Delta Green one is stalled merely because I am behind getting my my layout guy all the errata and corrections from his first draft, his first pass at converting Delta Green into because we're working not from the original files, we're working from the files that we used to create the D20 product, where we corrected a lot of errata in the book. And so what we did is we tried to just pull all the D20 material out and repackage it as a InDesign file from there. And I've got two or three pages of errata that I haven't – that was fan-submitted, where we opened it up and let some fans look at it last year. And I just haven't gotten – I just have not gotten that to my – all corrected back to my layout guy. Hopefully I can get that done this winter, so that sometime in January or February we can have this book ready, or at least have those files ready for folks who are going to buy it off of One Bookshelf or DraftRPG.
Great. We will promo the hell out of that.
Please do.
I'll also buy it.
Better. If I make 4 sales here today, I'm going to feel like it was time well spent.
Yeah. Totally. All right. So we've also got a new shop, I guess, a store at Zazzle.
Yeah, we've got a little podcast store set up that it essentially started off with our Celia Cilia giveaway, with asking people to send in artwork. And well, our first entry that we got, which was the one that won, was Mythos Babies. And it was so awesome that I had sent a message to the artist, Ian, and asked, hey, can I have a higher quality version of this, and we'll split the proceeds if I put these on shirts? And he's like, sure. So we started up a Zazzle store, so you can now get Mythos Babies on t-shirts, along with various other podcasty type of things on various products. There's not a whole lot there yet, but I'm kind of slowly working on ideas for stuff.
Yeah, I actually ordered one of the Mythos Baby shirts and wore it to Thanksgiving. It's actually quite nice.
Outstanding.
I have two.
Did they make you eat at the children's table at Thanksgiving while you had that shirt on? Or?
When you're 6'5", have a full beard, and wear a Mythos Babies shirt, they will let you sit wherever the hell you want.
I was going to say, that sounded like a recipe for the children's table, but all right.
Also called the nerd table.
To find that, we just have it up on mu-podcast.com/Zazzle, Zazzle.
Cool. Also, there's a new Kickstarter out there from Miskatonic River Press, our buddies over there.
It's for the
Punk Town, which I don't know, which is awesome, an awesome series of stories that have been around forever. And they're finally turning it into a scenario there, or a campaign. Yeah, it looks really awesome.
Has anyone checked? I thought they may have made their initial goals.
I am currently on the page, and no, they are not to goal yet.
Okay.
Their goal is 9,000, and they're currently at 6,186.
But they just go. But they just started too, though, right? Just a few weeks ago, right?
I think there's only like 9 days left.
So they're two thirds of the way there with two thirds of their time spent. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're on track.
So get this out. I'll have to remember to say something about it on my own social media because Tom's been good to us.
Yes, yeah, Tom is a great guy.
He's been tweeting it out and trying to share it as well, trying to get people on board. The artwork is amazing that they've shared. The cover is just mind-blowing.
Tom just got the stretch goals posted, and the one I'm excited about is if they can hit 15,000, they're going to create GM screens, specific Punktown GM screens. Think another adventure, something. I think there'll be another adventure in the book. So
that will not be sucky at all.
No, not at all. Now I'm going to have to give them some money.
Yeah, there's a few things that I'll throw money at, but Miskatonic University Press is one of them that I can always peel off of a few jacks for them.
Yeah, those guys, they do good work. It's beautiful stuff, everything they put out so far.
I particularly like their last Tales from the Miskatonic Valley. There was that scenario where the mayor of the town's kids have been killed. Spoiler alert. I don't remember the name of the scenario, but it was
the one, plot hook. Yeah.
Yeah. The mayor's kids have been kidnapped. And it's technically they have been kidnapped, but the Mego left their brains behind with the mayor in the brain cylinders. Yeah. And so dad's reading them bedtime stories, reading the soldiers' bedtime stories.
Yeah.
Just this little note about how he disconnected the audio boxes from the cylinders because the screaming and weeping had become tiresome.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Those two books are fantastic. The Miskatonic River Valley stuff is fantastic setting and a great campaign launcher. That's what I used it for. So highly recommend getting both of those and just running with Lovecraft Country.
Yeah, any campaign set around the university provides enough of a structure. Well, it provides the structure that we were looking for when we did things like Golden Dawn and Delta Green.
Yeah, right.
Right. And let's see.
What Eldritch horror is that in the background? I thought I heard something stirring. No, not in the spaces men walk in, but between them.
Nice.
That was John's kid. Who's obviously John's kid?
Yes, who's obviously looking for to watch Thomas. So I'm gonna throw on a DVD and be right back.
Okay.
We got a voicemail from a dude in Massachusetts that we probably should play. Let's play that while we're waiting on John to return.
Oh, hey there, Miskatonic University Podcast. This is Brian up in Massachusetts. Just wanted to call in and say hello, and that I thoroughly enjoyed the last episode, which was the pulp versus purist styles of play, or maybe not versus purist, but pulp and purist styles of play. I guess it doesn't have to be one versus the other. Right now, my group, we're running through Day of the Beast, the old Chaosium campaign, and we've had both pure pulp moments and some very purist moments as well. So we're really running along the spectrum and typically find ourselves somewhere in the middle of those two poles as we run through the campaign, and we're really enjoying that. Just wanted to say also, just a shout-out to John. I just received his I purchased and received his adventure, A Timeless Sands of India. Got that through an online games retailer, and I've not had the opportunity to read through it yet, but physically, graphically, it looks like a gorgeous presentation, and I guess, again, without having read it, I'm assuming, thinking back to the pulp and purist, the Goodman Games Age of Cthulhu line tends to have more of a pulp bent to it, so I'll be curious to read John's adventure and see where along the spectrum the Timeless Sands of India falls. And and again, just, you know, it's congratulations to him. I know it's a lot harder to put together a module and get it published and get it out there for people to enjoy. So thank you to John for for doing that, for getting that, putting it together and working with Goodman Games and getting that out to the fans and all of us that enjoy the game. So thanks, John, and I can't wait to read it. And, I guess I'll wrap up, say keep on, guys, keep on doing what you're doing, having a great time listening to it. I know we're heading to the holidays and schedules can get a little erratic, so I hope that the podcast keeps up its regular schedule as we head into the busy holiday time. But regardless, really enjoying the podcast, and as always, go Pods.
I wasn't convinced he was from Massachusetts until he said regardless.
Regardless. Yeah, no.
Okay.
Yep, there's sure. Confirmation.
There's the Massachusetts. Well, that was very cool. Thanks, Brian. And
Goodman's Games having a new product coming out. I didn't realize it was associated with one of you guys.
Yeah.
I understand. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. If you like your orange juice pulpy, this one is 90% pulpy. So,
yes,
so there you go.
It's more than 90. It's more than 90% pulpy. I got news for you.
I played through it on the Skype of Cthulhu podcast. And yeah, this sucker's all pulp. It's awesome.
Guys, I own all the Goodman Games stuff so far, and have sort of supported it just because, well, it's independent guys doing Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm.
I'll admit that Death in Luxor, the first one, I remember cracking it open, and when I read the part where it says the players fly into the Luxor airport, and my first thought was they didn't do any research.
Right.
I was like, they clearly, this is clearly coming from, a point of view like something out of The Shadow or The Spider or Doc Savage. There's going to be an airport because we need to get the players there in a hurry. But no, I was like, this Luxor is definitely the Luxor of the imagination. And it is like Cairo in India in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Right.
Is nothing like the Cairo that existed at that time. The Cairo that existed at that time is a little, it's freakily modern. The same thing like with the Cairo that shows up in Mask of Narlathotep. Cairo is weirdly modern with streetcars, cable cars that go out of central Cairo from the front of the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, and will take you all the way out to the frickin' pyramids. There's public transport, like buses, that will drop you off at the pyramids. The pyramids aren't some, creepy, out-of-the-way place. There's a giant luxury hotel built at the foot of the pyramids in an old hunting lodge that the Khedive or king of Egypt used to use, and now is this private hotel, and is just filled to the brim with European occultists who've come, every season to go out and commune with the pyramids, even in the 20s and 30s. Those people are out there to do their seances or play with their Ouija boards or crystals. And the Egyptians are like, yes, that's absolutely true. Go get out there and get that pyramid power, and thank you for your pound notes. It's just this giant sort of tourist mill. It's a little hard to punch Nazis under flying wings in that kind of an environment, or gun battles, have a raging gun battle through the streets of Cairo when they've got this, well, spiffily, turned out constabulary,
Yeah.
If you go with the stuff that's a little too historically based, it can sometimes suck the fun out of a scenario. So you've got to bend it, But that's still, as far as the old argument of purist versus pulp, I don't know. Was that argument more about purist Lovecraft or purist historical geek sort of stuff? I mean, or both?
We hit on both. Mostly the flavor of play.
Yeah, just trying to define it. We try and gear the show towards people that are new to the game, trying to grow the audience, and so that way people understand the terms.
I'll try not to run off new audience members.
I don't think that'll be a problem. I'll play the bumper.
All right.
Okay, make your listen roll.
Can I push this roll?
That's our 7th edition bumper there.
Yeah,
we're going to work on that.
You're playing Call of the Group. The answer is no. You can't push the roll. The dice hate you. The dice are your enemy. Okay. Anything you can do in the game not to roll dice, that's the best shit ever. Because there's no way the dice can fuck you. You know, we've certainly done things like, well, you could use a spot hidden, or you could tell me where you're looking. Oh, I'll tell you where I'm looking. When we're going to search something, you know, never let the dice do what you can just tell the keeper you're doing. Because holy crap, they're just waiting. They are the uncaring, unfeeling Lovecraftian universe ready to pounce.
Okay, so well, you got Scott's idea on how the push mechanic is.
I've heard you say this on the Unspeakable Oath podcast that you basically are generally against the changes in the 7th edition that give more power to players and more power to storytelling and away from the sort of uncaring coldness of the dice. Is that
so? I have said that, but I don't know how much is really going to happen with the 7th edition rules. I've heard all kinds of noise about, you know, the 7th edition rules. I've spoken with one or two people who actually work with Chaosium, and they're like, we're gonna mine that they're gonna mine that think tank for all kinds of goodies, but they're not necessarily gonna take what's coming, because I don't the 7th edition rules that I keep hearing about, as I understand it, well, maybe I'm misinformed, but there's nothing 100% guaranteed about this think tank of percolating ideas that's going on about it, that it's nothing official, that they're the first sort of gestation of rules that came out of this group was, you know, suggested vast changes for Call of Cthulhu, which some of the folks at Chaosium were like, well, we're not going that far, you know. But again, this is all unofficial. This is all just scuttlebutt. I don't think they're going to change. They have a formula that's worked very well for 30 years. When people talk about Call of Cthulhu, I really do not hear in my circle people going, well, this would be great if we just changed the rules. You know, what this really needs is a rules change, you know, a completely different system. People buy it. They, if they really don't want to run characters through the BRP rules system, you know, that's fine. You can strip mine, certainly with all the Pagans products like Delta Green, people just strip mine the background out and apply whatever rule system they want to it, and it works. You know, they're just happy to mine the story for ideas. But the Chaosium's system is so simple and so so straightforward. I don't really feel there's a lot of need to change it. And it's not just because it's the system I've been playing since 1982,
I think, is when it came out.
Yeah, I didn't play it the first year. I'm just saying, I picked it up sophomore year in high school, and so I've been playing it longer, for a longer period of time. That's over, you know, it's over half my life, and I'm a guy who's always squidgy about learning new rule systems, but it does what it needs to do. It does it pretty well. And I've certainly used it and adapted it for other genres because it's such a simple system. You know, simple, you know, basic stats, and then accomplishing tasks just becomes a matter of skill points. Excuse me. You know, it's why it was one of the reasons that I look at, like, the system that Bethesda used for their character creation in Fallout, the Fallout series. You know, just percentage skills, and they had some perks in there that you could buy when you leveled up, but it all came down to skill points. I mean, I'm not a big fan of hit point inflation for characters. I feel that what I want to do with characters is, you know, since, you know, a seal dies from the same injury that would have killed him when he was, you know, a Navy recruit going through boot camp. The same injury that'll kill him when he's, you know, an 18-year-old going through boot camp is the injury that'll kill him when he's a 34-year-old, you know, sure. member of SEAL Team 6.
Lethal's lethal, yeah.
Yeah. What I kind of want to do is want to try and maybe add some mechanic balance so that you're just harder to hit because your character, at least in combat, you know, with combat-oriented characters, you're just harder to hit because you're, you know, you're more in tune to your environment and combat and the use of cover and so on and so forth. But hit points, you know, loading up hit points where it's like, I've been hit 14 times. I got 2 hit points. I'll keep going. You know, I've had keepers who will just say, no, I'm not letting you know how much damage it did. I got shot in a game. And it's like, you feel woozy. Really? How many hit points was that? Well, I don't know. How many do you think it is?
Woozy enough.
Yeah. Can you see you see a rib? Huh? Really? I see a rib. Yep. Okay, that's not good then. No, it sure isn't. We had a player get shot dead in the chest during one game. Same game we weren't using. The keeper wasn't telling us the damage. And he got shot in the chest, and it was like, you know, there was a hole dead center of his chest. And the keeper said, yeah, it hurts. But you feel okay. And the player's like, oh, I'm in shock. I must be dying. I probably got 2 or 3 combat rounds before I just bleed out internally. So he jumps out from behind cover, rushes the cultists, you know, and guns them all down while they're just standing with their mouths open, being aghast that someone would jump out from behind their cover. And 5 or 6 combat rounds later, end of combat round, late in combat later, he's like, well, I don't appear to be dead. It's only then that, you know, after combat that, and a medic roll that we're like, oh yeah, that was 1 point of damage. That was a ricochet that hit a wall and bounced into your, and lodged in your sternum.
Nice.
For 1 point of damage. Your sternum's broken, you know, but I think you could get this out with a penknife, you know, if you really wanted to. And we're like, holy crap. All right.
That's a good reminder. Actually, that's really good practice, is to consider storytelling your damage rather than making it all about the points and point balance and all that sort of tactical stuff. Just go ahead and be dark with it and describe it medically. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and give them extra information if they make their first aid roll. Sure, if they make their first aid roll, maybe you'll tell them how many points that was worth. You know, mm-hmm. But as far as I know, it's... Well, the hole appears to have closed. There's no blood coming out, yeah, but your belly's swelling up, you know. Things like that make the players a lot more nervous. I mean, they should be nervous about combat anyways, because combat in real life is so lethal. Yeah. You know, yeah. you can be badass McGurk and still go down on a hail of bullets. I mean, you know, we were doing some Wild West stuff, and sure enough, I'm the guy who kicked in the door of the room, and there's 4 guys with guns in there, and I hit all 4 of them in the 2 or 3 combat rounds of shooting, killed 3, but you know what? There were 4 of them.
Yeah. You know?
And it did not work out for me at all. Not in a tight space like that, you know. But yeah, you're much better off shooting them in the back when they're asleep. If you can get your combat that way, that's the way to go. After all, there are no experience points.
Right.
You're not allowed to worry about, oh, you know, there's more experience points if he's awake. No.
Cultists do not hoard gold or rubies. Yeah.
Right. And if they do, you don't want it.
Yeah, that's right.
It'll be, you know, you'll hear it whispering to you in the night, you know, or you'll, or you'll wake up and the gold will have, you know, float up over your mouth and sealed your nose and mouth or some horrible shit like that. It's never good. The treasure you get in Call of Cthulhu, holy crap. Again, yeah. we got a copy of Unauspicious Flick and Colton one time, and we have played, I played Call of Cthulhu with John Crow, the writer of Bumps of the Night, for 10 years, and we got a copy of Unauspicious Flick and Colton. It was the first time we'd ever got a Mythos book. First time ever.
Hmm.
And we're like, holy shit, this is amazing. This is going to be important, right? Luckily, one of the players had brought along some German. Read German. As soon as he reads the book.
Luckily?
I shouldn't say luckily. He starts reading the book. He just starts, you know, poking around in it, and the book is booby-trapped. Ooh. It's booby-trapped with some horrible, you know, curse or whatever. So, you know, by the previous owner, some actual, you know, competent sorcerer has cursed the book. So he's literally bleeding out his ears, nose, and rectum within 24 hours of reading the book. And, yeah, we never fixed that problem. He ended up dying, rising from the dead, and then coming after me in the middle of the night, where he's knocking on my door, you know. You're okay. Oh, shit, you know, and then I'm fighting my head.
I loved, he's bleeding from the rectum, the eyes, the ears. We never fixed that problem.
No, we really didn't.
We tried everything. We tried tampons in the ass. We tried corks.
Depends. Nothing works.
Depends. Yeah. That's
it. Oh, my God. Nothing works.
Hydrogen peroxide enemas. Nothing mattered.
Ladies and gentlemen, what you are hearing now is an excerpt from the purest style of play from Adam Scott Quincy.
Well, we get both. But purest play versus pulp play, you know, pulpy shit will happen because your players will, you know, will be forced to do something pulpy, like jump from a moving train or, you know, hijack an airplane in mid-flight or, you know, have a running gun battle through the streets of Luxor, you know, in Model Ts with, you know, Tommy guns. That shit will happen. You know, you can't really prevent it. I will admit that when we play, you know, gunplay always attracts the cops, and there's always questions. And so, you know, we always try and figure out a way to, I don't know, maneuver the bad guys into a position where it looks like we're not at fault. You know, so that it doesn't look like we're just gun wielding maniacs who've hosed down the eccentric occultists, you know, who just happened to do, you know, they were doing Ouija board stuff, and these guys kicked the doors in and hosed down everybody with Chicago typewriters, you know. We try to not to make it look that obvious, but yeah. Where were we? I've gotten totally off on a tangent. See, this is what happens. You let me talk.
We invited you. we summoned you into the circle. Now we don't seem to have closed it. I just wanted to say that something that I love about Delta Green, and I know we're not in it yet, but I love that it sort of has an implicit cover-up phase after you've got the investigation phase, you've got the shit hits the fan phase, and then you've got the cover-up phase. And that's something that I particularly love about that setting, is that you're in on the conspiracy. You have to perpetuate the conspiracy. It's part of the mission statement.
I've heard people, you know, voices on various websites like Yogg-Sothoth complain that they just think it's morally reprehensible that the players are part of the cover-up.
I love it.
Retarded. Yeah. Come on.
That's why morally reprehensible is a goal.
It's morally reprehensible that the players should be involved in covering up, that makes them part of the problem. And I'm like, well, if we're not covering, if you want a world that looks like, say, Charles Strauss's A Colder War. Have you guys read A Colder War?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Okay.
No.
It was something he wrote before he started the Laundry books, which is his sort of British governments a la Le Carré or Ludlum versus the mythos. A Colder War is a Colder War, which appears in Book of Cthulhu and a couple of their Charles Strauss collections. And it used to be online. You could just find it where he originally was published online. It just shows a world of what happens when, you know, when knowledge of the mythos gets out. And the first thing that happens is that governments start trying to figure out how to use it as a resource,
sure,
how to weaponize it, how to, you know, provide unlimited power. All we have to have is generators full of shoggoths like gerbils on treadmills, on gerbil wheels. And, oh, look, it's, you know, green energy. We just have to keep, you know, feeding the generator, literally, you know, and it'll work out fine. And it's this horrifying world where, you know, they get their Armageddon a la all of the Cold War. But they use the weapons of the mythos to do it. And I'm like, well, if you want that world, you go ahead and tell everyone, you know. If you want people flocking to the, you know, it depends on, and this depends clearly on the kind of world you want a game in. You know, I tell people, you know, this is the Lovecraft universe. That means the Judeo-Christian eschatology doesn't work here. All right, whatever your personal belief system is, in this fantasy world, you can't hold up a cross. You can't pray to St. Jude. There will be no Archangel Michael. And, you know, and Satan is not using Cthulhu as a hand puppet. You are in a completely different mythology. You're going to have to deal with that. And this mythology, the eschatology of all those, all the religions of Abraham, don't work. So you create a world where you knowledge of gods who do answer your prayers or your rituals exists. You're going to have converts, massive amounts of converts. People are going to want to, I mean, there's going to be people who switch teams because, you know, when it comes to religion, the most important thing is being right. And so, you know, I myself am not a religious person, so I apologize if I'm offending anyone's senses and their practices. But you have to be part of, you know, in this mythology, you have to be part of the conspiracy. The idea that it was morally reprehensible for the players to suppress this knowledge, therefore, because they suppress the knowledge, the world would be less able to confront the problem when it arose. I think that was their argument. You know, if everybody knows how to make an altar sign, then, you know, everyone, then we'll all be protected. I'm like, no, no, because if you think it was shitty when those kids came to visit the high school in Colorado, just imagine what kind of trouble they can get up to if they can figure out how to whistle up Azathoth or, you know, Yagalanak or something. You know, it's going to be every edgy loner with a grudge because, you know, Miley Cyrus won't return his phone calls, you know, is going to be blowing shit up. I can't think of a worse possible world to live in.
Yeah, let's not put the mythos in the hands of pubescent teenage boys, for God's sake.
And as we learned, as I had learned in this last election, that we have many people who will flock to something if they're being given something. You know, if the promise of having something given to them, they will go for it. Or at least that's what I was told in the news. So if people are out there and they believe that they can gain something by, well, all you got to do is just say, you know, three Hail Azathoths, then they're going to do it.
There's always the idea that, yeah, that you're going to get a situation where, sure, all you have to do is tie a hobo up and throw him over the side of your rowboat, and the next morning there'll be a little pile of Spanish doubloons brought from the bottom of the sea, piled up on the beach for you. And the hobo wasn't doing anything anyways. What the hey? You know, it's that stuff. It's the story of Innsmouth. It's the whole, you know, Obed Marsh, you know, shtick where, you know, in the middle of economic hard times, he turns up and says, hey, I know some gods that'll actually answer prayers, you know? All you have to do is jump on the bandwagon, and humans, being the treacherous monkeys that they are, will sell out their fellow human beings in a heartbeat.
And then you have to start figuring out what's the correlation. Is it by number of hobos, weight of hobo, color of hobo? You have to try all combinations to see which one returns the greatest investment.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure that we won't run out of hobos, so I'm sure at no point will we have to start prioritizing townspeople or people who count. That will never happen. It'll be fine as long as we stay at home and, you know, mind our own business and, you know, don't ask any too many hard questions. I mean, you know, it's how you make creepy regimes around the world. Everybody just puts the leader's picture up in their office and hopes nobody overhears anything at lunch that, you know, could get them the attention of the priesthood or the secret police or whatever the problem is. Human beings have put up with worse things than some of these cults from Call of Cthulhu. They've just put up with worse situations. I mean,
have and are. Yes.
Yeah, look, check out North Korea sometime if you want to see a state that is perhaps the most, cult-like that I'm aware of. That's crazy town with an uppercase C.
You saw that they found the tomb of the unicorn there in North Korea, right?
I've seen that story wandering around the news. I don't know what I can never understand how they think any of that is going to help, or any time they make an announcement, they announce the most batshit crazy stuff. And like when right before Kim Il Pugsley, who's the latest guy? Kim Il Jun.
Pugsley, yeah.
Have you seen the guy? He's just,
No, the best part is whenever The Onion came out with that fake news, the sexiest man alive thing, and they responded in kind, like, oh, we know, thank you very much.
They live in a satire, sarcasm-free zone, I had some friends, Ross Payton over at RPPR keeps talking about trying to run a Call of Cthulhu scenario set in North Korea, where you have to navigate crazy land to do your investigation as...
Well, the traffic's never bad, so...
Oh, my God. The empty streets in Pyongyang, and yet there are these women standing on these little pedestals in the middle of four-way intersections doing this sort of Dallas Cowboys cheerleader-style, highly gymnastic car direction, hand-waving, and, it's this whole, Bugsby Berkeley dance routine on top of the pedestal to direct traffic that doesn't exist. There's nothing. There's just empty streets.
That is just a fantastic image to sum it all up. And
pretending that there's a reason to have someone directing traffic, at the same time they're not allowed to make eye contact with the hotel from hell. Giant black building that looks like it probably houses a Shan temple, ship. That big black pyramid that, turned out to be a financial boondoggle and an engineering boondoggle. They can't actually complete it, but just they'd have to demolish it and start over again. So state policy is don't look at it, don't mention it, don't talk about it.
Nice.
It's the most prominent landmark in the city, and if you ask for directions, no one's allowed to reference it, they took it off the stamps. Those stamps no longer exist, comrade. Have the new stamps. Anyways, enough of North Korea. But, engaging the players in the cover-up always seems really pertinent because, it depends. I don't think that I have a particularly dire view of humanity's weakness, necessarily, but I do think that there's always going to be people looking to take the shortcut. And most of the stuff that we try and do is not necessarily these kind of mythos hoedowns that you used to get back in the 80s where they would just, throw every mythos critter and god together into one big happy, conspiracy to get the monkeys. Erase humanity from the globe. The stuff that we tend to move towards is things where people start dicking around with the mythos with the best intentions. I'm gonna cure polio, or I'm gonna bring my son back from the dead, or anything along those lines. And yes, it always turns to shit because it's the mythos. but that's the kind of thing that we almost always try and go towards, where oftentimes the movers and shakers and the stories are still humans. But it's the it's their contact with the it's they're the point of contact with the mythos, as opposed to the mythos having some sort of agenda, which I just don't know that the writing necessarily suggests that. the Necronomicon is yet another book from that deserty part of the world that purports to have all the answers in it, but it's still written by a guy, you know, and the idea that it says in it, oh, everything I say is true. And, you know, all of my prophecies are accurate. And it's all, if you don't get on board the Fatagan train, you know, you're going to get left behind or whatever. I sort of wonder, you know, if no one's ever considered that, you know, there may be huge swaths of the Necronomicon that are just your standard religious propaganda.
Yeah, still just, you know, human.
Yeah, it's still just a human interpreting this stuff and getting it completely, you know, getting some of it wrong in ways that we'll never know. I don't mind that as a possibility for the mythos, because it doesn't matter, because the mythos still exists, like gravity or dark matter or any other physical aspect of the universe that we don't have answers, don't have all the answers for.
I have it. Let me jump in, since we've jumped into Delta Green for sure now.
Oh. Wait. Before we do that.
Wait.
No, let's try and keep this halfway in order. So
can I bookmark a question then?
Yeah, you can bookmark a question.
All right.
But before we do that, we have a new lecture from Dr. Gerard at the Miskatonic University History Department. This one happens to be on the topic of the Dream Hunters of Corsica.
From the Miskatonic University Department of History.
Stone megaliths bearing time-tortured faces tell us that hunter-gatherers first settled on the mysterious Mediterranean island of Corsica up to 9,000 years ago. The islanders remained strangely isolated over the millennia despite being within eyeshot of France and Italy. They repelled attacks from the Carthaginians, Etruscans, and Greeks. Romans arrived later but clung to the coasts. Vandals, Ostrogoths, all stopped over, but left the people and the ancient culture largely untouched. Even Christianity was slow to take hold. Remnants of a fierce megalithic religion lasted well into the 20th century. There are stories dating back thousands of years to a peculiar Corsican affliction from which some islanders suffer. They're known as dream hunters, or Mazzeri. These Mazzeri sometimes sleepwalk, wandering around at night between worlds. Instinctively, they hunt, often drifting down to the closest running water, which is considered to be a symbol of evil on Corsica. Nothing good ever came from the water, as they say. The somnambulists then sometimes recognize the face of a known villager on the head of their quarry. Then they kill the animal with a human face, usually with primitive weapons, spears, stones, and clubs. The preferred weapon is a heavy staff or cudgel known as a mazza, usually cut from the root and stem of a vine. The next day, they will talk about their dream, and within 3 days, the person whose face they saw will die. Many of the Mazzeri are elderly women, or otherwise peaceful shepherds. They are said to have no animosity toward their victims. Mazzeri initiation takes place in dreams, often called to service by an elder mentor who meets the protege in dreams and takes them on a hunt. In legend, entire clans of dream hunters will meet in the night to battle, sometimes to settle deep-seated scores, sometimes just to appease the gods. Over the last century, Corsicans have become known for their prowess as enforcers and assassins. They played a key role in the rise of organized crime after World War II, aided in no small part by the CIA. When American spooks wanted to stop communist unions organizing in southern France, they hired unemployed Corsicans to break up the picket lines. This unsavory marriage gave birth to a massive heroin smuggling operation, aided by corrupt Corsican politicians and the French counter-espionage agency. It connected Turkish opium to Marseille and from there all around the world. The network was known as the French Connection. In 1961, Corsicans were recruited in Puerto Rico to help form Alpha 66, a CIA-backed organization dedicated to overthrowing Fidel Castro. One of the theories about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy involves three Corsican hitmen, one of them Lucien Sarti, who confessed in jail on hopes of winning his freedom. The story was partly supported by a deathbed confession from CIA operative and Watergate fall guy E. Howard Hunt. If true, why would Corsicans be chosen for such a job? An interesting footnote, the FBI was founded in 1908 by the great-nephew of the world's most infamous and ruthless Corsican, Napoleon Bonaparte. But perhaps there is another reason why Corsicans seem to be so suited for the darkest jobs. Perhaps these master assassins are in fact meseri, who hone their craft in their sleep. So then, who is really calling them to service? For more information about the mysteries of Corsica, consult Dorothy Carrington's books about the island, available at the Orne Library. This lecture series is sponsored by the Miskatonic University Department of History.
Sweet. Sweet and horrible. Aren't the Corsicans the ones that have that? Aren't the Corsicans the one that have that horrible cheese that has the maggots in it?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, is that the Corsican maggot cheese?
Yes, that's the spawn of Ihort cheese.
Spawn of Ihort.
If ever there was a reason to, you know, just arc light the whole place square mile by square mile, it's that damn cheese right there, you know, right there. The cheese of doom is enough. Now that I hear they got dream murderers, I'm like, okay, we're done with this Corsica thing. If nothing good is nothing good came from the water. Yeah, nothing good came from Corsica.
I don't know, heroin distribution, pretty good stuff there, you know.
Without them.
I'm sorry, are you a junkie? Is that what you think?
I was about to ask the same thing.
Yeah. Well, ask an addict.
Oh, that I'm stuck with that crappy Mexican black tar heroin. I need some nice Turkish.
That's right.
I need some Turkish delight.
Yeah, that was grisly.
I'm definitely inserting Corsicans into my next adventure.
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but Corsica and Sardinia both have this reputation for being bandit cultures like Afghanistan. Like, there's no economy except going and taking other people's away from them, you know? It's kind of how a number of warrior societies devolved over the centuries, where, you know, they create this very martial society built around, you know, the manly art of beating the crap out of each other, and then they don't know how to make or do anything.
There's there's the same problem that happens in a number of counties in East Texas, actually. I live there, so I can claim that.
So they just keep it. That's the kind of county they keep in a glass jar marked in case of war.
Right.
Yes. It's the kind of county where if you run from the cops and you happen to actually are stupid enough to run into the swamp, the cops just sit and wait. Because you're either going to come out dead or you're going to run back out, one or the other. They don't really give a shit.
It does seem like places with rugged, mountainous interiors just give birth to these. I mean, you know, it helps train them for guerrilla warfare, and then they're hard to squash, so.
There's a great line from one of are you familiar with the Flashman books?
Yes.
By George MacDonald Fraser.
Yeah. No.
He writes about this sort of 19th century sort of James Bond action adventure hero who, you know, is involved in every important historical event of the last 50 years of the 19th century, from 1850 forward. He's, you know, at Harper's Ferry. He's there during the first Afghan War. He's fighting Borneo pirates. He's crossing the Great American West, you know, on the Oregon Trail. The main characters, yes, his reputation is 19th century James Bond, derring do, all for queen and country. But the truth of the matter is that he is a coward and a braggart and a bully and a thug and a racist and a misogynist and an idiot. And he's writing his memoirs as he's dying, is how the books are arranged. Kind of like, now I'm going to tell the truth about all that bullshit. Here's how I got the Victoria Cross. You know, some other guy did it. I just took the credit, you know. And he just writes these books, you know, the books are written from the sort of the hand of Harry Flashman as he's sort of undoing his family's good name as his last fuck you, I guess, to Victorian society. To just let them know that, you know, no, it's all bull. I'm the worst kind of character. And he is. He's a marvelous anti-hero.
But it's absolutely hilarious, too.
Yeah, it's beautiful history. It's extremely well-done history, and it's absolutely hilariously written. And there's just this one bit where he's talking about the India mutiny in the 1850s, I guess it was. It was the big mutiny in India. And describing how arranged against the British forces were, you know, various Pathan and Afghan hill tribesmen, you know, who had, for however many coins, had come and joined the mutineers to throw off British rule, the rule of the Raj. And he says, fortunately, we'd brought our own bloodthirsty hill tribesmen in the form of the Scottish Highlanders. And I'm like, yeah, actually, that's exactly right. You know, you put a few bumps in a country, and wherever the badasses are from, it's usually where the bumps are. You know, it's not like Sergeant York didn't come from, you know, Brooklyn. You know, they fished Alvin York out of West Virginia. You know, tough country makes tough people.
Yep.
I think that was the whole point of Frank Herbert's Dune. But all right, moving along.
Sure. Afghanistan, Appalachians, Aceh. Yeah.
Corsicans, they're part of that long tradition of badasses marooned in some rugged, nasty country. And yeah, they just have that reputation of being bandits and kidnappers and gangsters from forever back. Yeah.
And giant cannibals, even. Going back to the Laestrygonians?
Yeah. This isn't Polyphemus, right? Polyphemus isn't from Corsica.
No, but the giants, they stopped over, Odysseus stopped over, and these giants threw boulders from the mountains of Corsica and took out a good portion of his fleet.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the development of the new Delta Green.
Right.
Because that's what a lot of guys are wanting to hear about.
Definitely. Preview.
So what made y'all decide to split from COCBRP rule set and kind of go to your own route?
Well, you'll notice that the rule set they're working on is so close to BRP that I wonder why we're claiming we're splitting. I feel that it's very close.
Okay.
There's not going to be a lot of really massive changes. We're sticking to a percentage based rule system for skill, for accomplishing skills, and that is sort of the heart of BRP. But we're going to be doing a variant of that. We wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to convert over. One of the reasons for that is we're not going to reprint the original books. The idea is to get them all available through Drive-Thru RPG as as print on demand or PDF. But we're not going to do something where it's like, well, now you have to rebuy all the books over again. What we want to do is set up a situation where you can take your original book, look at it, and the job of converting from the from Casim's BRP to the system that we'll be using will be painless and intuitive, rather than have to do a lot of math or convert, you know, do a lot of conversion. So we're not planning to make it difficult that way. And, you know, that way, again, we wouldn't have to. If you bought the first books, you know, we're not going to try and set up a situation where neener, you have to buy everything over again. I know that's the marketing ploy that's been used for decades in the game industry, but I hate it. And if we had any brains, we'd make you buy every book over again, but we're just not going to do it. We're also splitting.
Thank you for that.
We're also splitting the books up into two books. There's going to be a player's book and a keeper's book. That'll be the first things that are put out. So there's the book that every player can pick up, and it's going to have a whole bunch of lore, and the keeper should definitely have it because it's going to be what your players know about Delta Green. It'll be the open face of Delta Green. Mm-hmm. And then the keeper will have his section goes, oh, no, no, no. They think it's like this, but really it's like this. And you'll there will be backstory. So players will be able to pick up a book, and the player's book will have character creation, basic skill, task resolution, combat rules in it. You know, it'll be all the mechanics of the game, you know, plus information about the world, the game world you're entering into. The keeper's book is going to be much more about that's where you're going to find, say, the magic section. That is supposed to be a mystery to players, that'll be the section on, you know, tomes and critters, things like that. That'll be separated out from the other stuff. And it'll also be the stuff where it flushes out parts of the world that the players are going to need to discover, that half the fun is them learning these facts about this world. So there will be a little bit of repetition there, but only so far as to make sure that the keeper doesn't have to flip back and forth between two books to understand what's going on, you know, with Majestic 12 this week, because half the information's in the player's book and half the information's in the keeper's book, you know. So there will be some repetition there, so for the keeper's convenience. But we're going to try and keep it divided up like that.
So who's working on that?
Right now we've got myself, Shane Ivey, Dennis Detweiler, Ken Height has been contracted to write some stuff, and Greg Stolze has been contracted to write some stuff. John Tynes has a serious grown-up job at Microsoft and has volunteered to act as a kind of uncle who can dispense clever wisdom and possibly review manuscripts, but he won't be actually doing any writing on this, but he will be doing some editorial approval on writing that gets done for it.
Now, I know that that Ken just took a position over at Pelgrim Press. I was wondering, is that going to affect the release of the system at all, or is his stuff...
He has not made that apparent to me yet. It hasn't come to me saying, whoops, you know, Ken's out. I haven't heard that yet. So I'm presuming that, but Ken's a monster. I mean, have you seen the body of his work?
Yeah.
He needs four or five projects at the same time. He'll be fine. I have, I'm more worried about, you know, us being able to, I'd be more worried about us trying to pay for him for everything he's capable of writing. Cause he can poop out 100,000 words, you know, in a month. They go, here we go, manuscript, whole new world, studiously researched, done. Mm-hmm. If you let him at it, that's how it'll turn out.
Must be nice. I'd like to revive a question that I bookmarked, that is we want to bring it back to new keepers. We have experienced keepers listening to the show, but we also have brand new keepers running their first stuff. And so I want to ask you, advice for new keepers, and if you could be specific, what scenario would you suggest they run for a first-time Delta Green campaign or one-shot?
There's two that are not bad for that. Let's see here. Puppet Shows and Shadow Plays was designed as an introduction scenario.
Right, right.
So that's not a terrible choice right there. The other one that's not bad is PX Poker Night. That makes a pretty good introduction where you get some supernatural horrible stuff that happens out at the airbase, and you can be recruited into Delta Green because you survived the scenario. Those are both two pretty good options. As far as I've had a lot of luck running Last Things Last in a convention setting. That was a scenario that was written by a guy named Brett Kramer for one of the shotgun scenario contests that they have on the Delta Green mailing list. And he came up with – he has two or three scenarios that have won that contest over the years, because he's just very adept at being able to do – these scenarios are supposed to be like less than 3,000 words, And, God knows, we would always get scenarios that were like, a 3,000-word summation of a campaign. And like,
right.
Nope, that ain't it. But Kramer could, was always really good at being able to turn in these sort of one-night one-shots, which are quite good. And Last Things Last is very interesting to me because it provides not only a taste of the supernatural, that can be beefed up depending on the size of the party, so the group of people involved with it, or toned down depending on how many players are involved. And it does a pretty good job of sort of illustrating the desperate state of being in Delta Green, where you're, there's no gold watch on retirement. Just when you die, some members of the conspiracy break into your apartment and go ransacking it, looking for any sign that you've kept anything related to the conspiracy. A journal, photographs, ticket stubs. And that's how Last Things Last picks up. You are the cleanup team.
Yeah, see, that's great. So you get into that cover-up moral ambiguity stuff.
Get to a guy's apartment who's, got apparently no friends. He's estranged from his family. He doesn't do anything. He's got, piles of crossword puzzles. He's got the New York Times crossword puzzle done in ink, piled up in his apartment. He's brilliant. But, he's kind of cut off. Doesn't have a TV. Doesn't have a computer. It's some Cold War relic. And it's like, this is your future. The only thing you see of the guy is that tape outline on the bathroom floor where he fell over and had a heart attack the previous day. And you go through his shit looking for, you go through his stuff looking for any signs that he has committed the cardinal sin of Delta Green, and that is kept souvenirs, anything that was dangerous or could connect him back to the larger conspiracy, and you're supposed to perform this operation without breaking locks and knocking things over because the family is going to come, and sort through his stuff. The kids he hasn't seen in 10, 15 years are going to come and go through his stuff and sort out his effects for the will and testament. And you find that, you eventually find that he did leave some unfinished business behind. And that's the setup for Last Things Last. And it's as far as an introductory scenario to sort of tell you what you're going to be facing in Delta Green, what your future looks like. It's actually extremely effective.
That's a great mood setter. Yeah.
And it's also fairly low key. There is there's a monster. It's fixable. It's not too terrible, but it's pretty terrible. You're not going to enjoy it. And I've played it a bunch of times and I've had wildly varying results, with the players of, depending on their actions,
So it's not prescripted.
No. It's not a sandbox, but because it's a 3,000 word scenario, but
stuff has to happen.
Holy crap. It sets the mood. It tells you what you've got to look forward to on your career in Delta Green. A slowly, or perhaps not so slowly, narrowing circle of acquaintances, friends, and contacts as, people attrit, as it were, because they're involved with this, very isolated and insular existence with no rewards, no accolades, no medals, no parades, no gold watch, as they say around the Delta Green mailing list. No gold watch.
So, where did y'all actually come up with the idea for Delta Green? I mean, what was the, the piece of inspiration or whatever that brought that around?
Well, John Tynes is the guy responsible for that, and he's told the story several times. And I guess the main thing it comes down to was, he's always said that it kind of revolved around Masks of Nyarlathotep. They played Masks of Nyarlathotep in college, and it was one of the first things they did with Call of Cthulhu. And the casualty rate was abysmal. It was horrific. they had, you know, there's a point where they gave up naming their characters. They had been through so many characters in it, you know. There was a character named Backwash McJesus, I think, at one point. And there may have been a character named Bumfuck McJesus. I don't remember. But it got to the point where, you know, they just had so many casualties. They're like, where are all these new people coming from who are so interested in Jackson Elias and his damn, you know, his death and this cult? And how come we keep getting people who are willing to, you know, turn up? Like, you know, gee, we lost half the party in Cairo. Let's go down to the lobby of the hotel and see if there are any, you know, archaeologists / commandos who are just, you know, hanging around. You know, come with us and fight evil. Oh, luckily the bellhop is a veteran of the Great War and a trench fighter and also happens to be an Egyptologist. That'll be great. And so, you know, they were replacing characters like that. And John was like, well, this is ridiculous. We need campaign settings for Call of Cthulhu. Call of Cthulhu didn't have a campaign setting. Mm-hmm. Perhaps if it was being published today, the campaign setting would be Miskatonic University.
Right.
That would be your campaign setting. Everyone starts off a staff with people related to Miskatonic, and you branch out from there on your adventures. But you'd start off with the pool of recruiting characters, the pool of getting resources to do your investigations, and that sort of thing, and your and your big file cabinet full of leads, you know, the Glengarry leads, the good leads. Those would all come from Miskatonic University. It'd be the clipping service that, you know, to the next, you know, archaeological expedition that's going to unleash the next, you know, dead god or whatever. And, you know, Call of Cthulhu didn't have that. Now, for those of you who have The Golden Dawn, which was our source book for sort of Victorian London, sort of our Gaslight source book back from, I guess, 95 or 96. Golden Dawn did the same thing that Delta Green did. It created an organization that was unofficial, but was a society. They used the Golden Dawn as a kind of, you know, occult clearinghouse where you'd have all these like-minded individuals. People interested in the cult are going to join the Golden Dawn. So you have an excuse why there are all these believers in your circle. And they're all looking for information about the occult or the supernatural, so the Golden Dawn is going to be a clearinghouse for that information. Newspaper articles, magazine articles, scholarly journals, it's all going to come through that organization because everybody's, all these NPCs you never have to meet, there's always sort of milling this stuff for information about the supernatural, and that's going to lead you to your next scenario. And then, you know, if somebody gets killed, there's replacement characters as other members of the society can step forward and say, you know, they'll take up the banner. And Delta Green does that, but set in the modern age. You know, we didn't want it to be the Men in Black because first of all, you know, the Sondheim film didn't exist then. But we also didn't want to create a situation where the players can just, you know, push a button and fix the problem. Send some Marines down there. And if that doesn't work, carpet bomb. You know, I've got lunch with the president. We wanted to make sure that there wasn't a situation that could lead to that Charles Strauss scenario where, you know, if the government's involved, some bright guy's going to go, well, of course, the sorcerers of Atlantis screwed up and sank their whole continent, but we're not that stupid. We're smarter than them. Well, I'm sure we can make this stuff work to our advantage, and it won't be that many versions we have to throw in the volcano. We wanted to make, you know, John created an idea for an organization that would be a defunct supernatural spy agency left over from, I'm not sure if I was the guy who added the OSS stuff or not. It's been so many years. I can't remember if that was in the original idea. But John had the idea that it was defunct. It was a Vietnam vintage Pentagon thing that was defunct. And so it was now an old – but you now had sort of a secret society within the government.
with a that needs a job. Yeah, it needs a mission.
And they still have their mission. They have their mission. They just don't have their budget.
Right.
There's no budget. There's no, you know, but it becomes that's how Delta Green was formed out of a necessity. A necessity for creating a campaign structure for gaming. And that's why it was so eagerly met, I think, when it came out in 96 and 97 was that it provided a structure that just hadn't been there before.
Yep.
Yeah, people were hungry for that sense of buy-in in the party, a single mission and a framework.
It didn't hurt that Chris Carter was still cranking out the X-Files at the
time. Yeah, sure.
And that was the big, the zeitgeist of the mid-90s was, you know, we'd lost the Russians, so clearly there are no more exterior enemies, right? So clearly the only enemy can be the government.
That's how the Delta Green book starts, right? It's funny how everyone distrusts the government nowadays. And here we are in 2012, nearly 13, and things have changed a bit.
Well, now, the thing that's always amusing to me about the change is, and it's something we've tried to incorporate into the new Delta Green material, is during the Cold War, our intelligence agencies did us, the American public, a great favor.
Right.
By never telling us anything. They never told us anything. So when we found out about trying to assassinate Castro or overthrowing the Shah or Arbenz in Guatemala or Allende in Chile or, any of a number of dodgy things we did over the years, manipulating trade unions in Greece and France and, you know, playing with the elections in Australia, things like that, they never told us they were doing this stuff. So when we found out about it, we got to be all indignant and shit. We all got to be terribly indignant and filled with moral outrage about, you know, oh, wow, they didn't ask our permission before they, you know, assassinated Patrice, what was his name, Lumumba in Angola, the president of South Korea, Diem, and his wife, you know. And again, those are examples that are sort of tangentially connected to the CIA, but, you know, there's a lot of argument that I think most of it vow that they're not really that involved, but more along those lines. The sides that we supported in those conflicts did a lot of nasty stuff, and we turned a blind eye because it was, you know, pushing back the Red Menace. But, you know, when it came to, you know, things like the radiation experiments on the mentally ill, you know, and things like that. All that stuff was done in secret, and we were never told about it. And when we finally learned about it, we were all horrified, and we got to stand around and puff out our lower lip and be horrified about it. What strikes me about the current conflict since 2001 is our intelligence agencies and our military have been quite loudly trumpeting some of the nasty stuff that we've been doing. And for the most part, the American public's reaction has most of the time been, well, why aren't you doing more?
Yeah.
You know, right. I see you're, you know, drone bombing Pakistan, but couldn't you move up from drone to carpet? I mean, you know, I don't feel safe yet. And there's kind of this thing on what you hear about the black sites, you hear about we're having an open debate about enhanced interrogation, about torture in this country. At least we were in the 2000s. And we were actually having the argument over torture, which stuns me that there were talking heads and pundits who are going to stand up and try and, you know, and go with the argument that they're not torturing enough. Right. That there isn't, that there should be more torture, that we should, you know, should expand the program so that we can all be safer.
The waterboarding needs more water.
Yeah, yeah. Clearly, there's not enough water on that board. You know, could we add electricity? Would that be better? And it's this weird public debate where, you know, everybody's, you know, in this attempt to mollify the public to make everybody, you know. And I'm sorry, I'm not a big fan of the TSA. I think the TSA is a kind of a
joke.
It's a joke, and it's kind of a dog and pony show to make everyone feel safer. I'm not saying that our intelligence agencies aren't doing a relatively decent job of intercepting any kind of a plan that takes more than one person. I mean, that's the, you know, they're doing all right there. It's just when the one nut job, you know, because he's been stoked by whatever he's picked up on the internet, decides that he's going to go down and pick up his fertilizer or his gun or whatever and do a mass shooting or try and do a bombing on his own. There's not a lot they can do about that, you know, because that's a conspiracy of one. But they've done a fairly decent job policing up some of these retards. My favorite stuff being, of course, the stuff where the FBI poses as extremists and gets a bunch of idiots to go, yeah, we'd love to blow some stuff up. And then they're all seem to be so disappointed when everybody turns out to be a Fed and that there was no, again, that just shows to me that there's, that we've done such a good job of beating up on Al-Qaeda that they can't even find fellow travelers to work with at this stage because Al-Qaeda has been so pummeled over the last decade. But, you know, in the Cold War, we were not implicated. We were, our hands were clean. We could be, you know, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, that they did those nuclear tests or marched soldiers through Ground Zero back in the 50s and gave them, you know, got cancer. We can be all indignant about that. But in this recent conflict, the public, you know, it's much more public. And the public is weirdly involved in the debate on, and since every politician doesn't want to be the guy who goes, gee, TSA is costing a ton of money and I'm not sure it's really doing its job, maybe we should scale it back. First time there's an incident on a plane, that's the guy who doesn't get his seat in Congress back.
Right.
The guy who, you know, he's the guy who said, he's the guy who left us, who conspired with terrorists, you know, to leave us vulnerable because he hates America, you know. That's what you're going to get in the next election cycle. So everybody's, you know, nobody wants to be discontinuing Guantanamo and the indefinite detentions because nobody wants to be the guy who's going to end up having to pay a price in the election cycle if something goes wrong. So the world, our relationship with our secret agencies is very different. Our secret agencies aren't quite so secret anymore. There's a lot of public contractors out there from the private sector who are, attached onto these things like Lamprey, or tapeworms, and sort of bloating the system. And, you know, it means that, you know, that's the world we're going to have to plan the new Delta Green in. It's not the post-Cold War world anymore.
And pretty fertile stuff for those gray area purist moods, right?
Certainly, it really helps us explain, you know, it'll be easier to explain where Delta Green gets some equipment or some budget. At this point, because, you know, we lost pallets of cash in Iraq. I mean,
yep.
I'm always amazed by that.
Tons.
Literally tons of $100 bills. We don't know where they are. We can't account for them. Well, I can, at least in my fiction.
Right.
You know, in my fiction, I know right where that stuff is. It's being used to fight the good fight.
Where's my pallet?
Yeah.
Right. All right, let's take a small break right now and listen to a Scooby Thulu song.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, right?
This is awesome.
I'd had enough of rubber masks and holograms and flash bombs and machine-made fog. I'd had enough of those meddling kids and the stupid talking dog. I found my deliverance in the prison library, hidden in an ancient tome. I found the words that would grant my vengeance, rouse the old ones from their home. warm. Near a quaint old town, there was shelter found in a haunted bed and breakfast. A place to dry off and get warm.
I'm just going to go ahead and say that, yes, that's everything I wanted from the Mr. Machine. meeting the great older ones and more.
Yeah, that was course, Mikey yeah. Mason off of the, is he's got a new album called Barbarian Jetpack. It's all geek Dan. Stuff
and
awesome.
And other word salad.
Oh, only Dan can come up with this.
Damn it, Professor! There's some large gelatinous blob oozing towards us! It's falling from the air vents!
Oh, good grief. Not another Shoggoth, Jimmy. I thought I told you to stay out of the special collections section of the Orne Library.
I'm sorry, Professor, but now is not the time. What do we do?
Bother me, will you? Jimmy, it is rather simple. Just throw this at it.
What? But there's nothing in your hand, Professor! Hurry! It's getting closer! Oh my god! The eyes!
Now that is where you are wrong, Jimmy. A Shoggoth is a being not entirely of this world, correct? To curtail it, then, you need a weapon not entirely of this world. What I hold in my hand is an Audibles.com audiobook, one specifically by Bertrand Russell, speaking of the validity of logic over intuition.
Professor! It enters the day! Do something, man!
Fine, Jimmy.
Oh, wow, Professor, it's disappearing.
But of course, Jimmy. And remember, you can arm yourself with weapons against the Shoggoth by going to www.mu-podcast.com/audible and signing up for the free trial. Audible.com has the largest library of audiobooks and presentations anywhere on the internet. Remember, Jimmy, www.mu-podcast.com/audible. It might just save your life.
Oh, let's talk about your experience using Kickstarter to fund the Bumps in the Night. How was it? Was it worth doing again? Would you do it again?
I was a tard. I held off doing Kickstarter for about 6 months. Actually, almost a year, because I was thinking, well, I'll sell pre-orders of the book, and I did, and I sold about half the print cost in pre-orders, and I did not, and it was just lingering, and you know the pre-orders came in and they stopped coming in, and it wasn't going anywhere. I'm like, well, you know, we'll try this. I just needed $2,500 to finish the print, and you know, I was hesitant because I didn't want. Had this idea that Kickstarter's going to take 4% and Amazon's going to take 4-5%, and I'm going to lose about 10% of the money, you know. But what do I get out of it? I'm not going to get out. Well, I got to tell you, yeah, sure, Amazon did a great job of processing other people's credit cards for me and taking 4%. Maybe that's more than my own credit card processing service takes, but you know, it was worth it. The services that are provided by Kickstarter for someone who's doing one of my size, where I had about 250 people to keep track of, who had contributed, the email contact, the, using the site to, sort of manage their information, their reward system, things like that, that was worth the 4%. That was absolutely worth the 4%. I felt that was money well spent, and we got our $2,500 in the first 11 hours that the Kickstarter was up. Nice. It stopped around 12,000.
Yeah.
And the result was is that I was, yeah, there was the result was that I was able to pay some artists who had illustrated for it, you know, pay them off, rather than have to have them wait for, money to come back from the printing. We got to pay a few other Pagan Publishing outstanding debts, and you know that money went away very quickly. It also was a good thing we raised that much because I had miscalculated. I really needed to raise about $3,500, including all the shipping costs once I calculated in Some of the expenses about, I just had not done a great job calculating my expenses as far as packing materials, what I was going to, and time and things like that. It was a really good experience. I would highly recommend it. Now, the trick is, I had a product that was completely done. I had a product that was laid out, proofread, spell checked, edited, illustrated, completely ready to go. So we were able to turn it around in about, I guess it was like 3 or 4 months, about 4 months, I guess, between collecting everybody, getting the last amount of money, and depositing in our account, and then sending the book off to the printer, and then getting the proofs back, and then sending them back to get printed, and waiting for the shipment, and having them available at Gen Con in August. And we had everything. And the sad thing that was that because we were bumped up to that close against Gen Con, we were not able to ship out to everybody who'd ordered a book or who had, you know, contributed before Gen Con. So we went to Gen Con and ended up having to give books to people who, you know, they could present proof that they were on our – we brought our list of Kickstarter contributors to Gen Con, and so people were able to pick their books up there. But I would have really preferred to have been able to get all that out in the mail to people before Gen Con, because the deal was that they were supposed to get their books first, before anybody else. But people were relatively good-humored about that. Nobody really, you know, complained that how dare you take the books to Gen Con and sell them and, you know, make money when I'm supposed to get the book first, even if it costs you money, costs you sales. Nobody jumped up and said that. However, everybody got their books long before it made it to distributors and to retailers. So that was part of sort of the promise that you get yours before everybody else. Mm-hmm. Now, Chad did not get his before everyone else, but he did get one. It was Chad I sent it to, was it?
Nope, it was me.
Yeah, oh, I'm Dan.
Sorry. Dan. All right, yep, well, you've got one in your right hands. Here.
I got it like 3 days ago.
All right. And did you have any time to look at it before the the show?
I'm not reading through extensively, but I have read through each of the scenarios, and I'm really, really liking this book. I can't wait to run something out of it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of running non-mythos, especially, you know, if you have a campaign, it's a great way to break it up a little bit and not make it quite so all Lovecraft all the time, and tap into whatever local legends that you might have in your area. So this is five scenarios that all tap into some kind of real folklore, and I think it shows you that there's so much material out there that you can tap on your own, and these are great examples of how to do it.
Yeah, yeah,
and I think using stuff that is non-mythos helps make, when you do have your mythos encounters, make them more important, horrific. You know, and horrific, you know, so that it's not, oh, that's right, okay, now it's this mythos guy, and it's not like you're going down through the monster manual of some sort.
Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely. And I like the resistance to taking folklore and making it a sort of veil of the mythos. I don't think that's necessary all the time. I mean, you know, if you have creatures that are in the woods and that you want to assume that they are dark young, that's fine. But there are plenty of great other creatures in the woods, and Lovecraft certainly borrowed from real folklore everywhere. So,
well, I myself think that that really depends on the resistance to that idea depends on how you're going to view your game world. If you want a world where the mythos is the game world, and you know there is no other supernatural tradition or supernatural entities that can't trace their lineage back to an aspect of the mythos, that's fine. And there could be there's a certain amount of fun trying to connect real life stuff back to the mythos. I mean, John Tynes did a great job with hooking the mythos around, or the mystery around the Sheila na Gig back into the Shub-Niggurath cult. Sheila na Gigs are these fertility symbols that appear in a lot of English
graphic fertility symbols.
Yeah, that appear on these old British buildings, and they're related to the Celtic culture before the Anglo-Saxon invasion. But their meaning has been lost to history. So, gee, if there's no meaning, I can, you know, I can certainly backtrack that into the mythos, no problem. you know, so on the other hand, you know, I get a lot of flack from people about the scenario Puppet Shows and Shadow Plays, because there's an aspect in that where the Amerindian coyote spirit shows up in the story as a possible option if the players are stumbling around and can't find their way to the scenario and are bumbling around. You can bring in this coyote spirit that will appear in dreams, will appear as an offstage actor, but evidence of its passing will be there, like footprints, or it'll dig up the dead bodies that have been carefully buried out in the desert, or it'll lead footprints to a clue, you know, or something. And it'll, you know, it will appear in the story and interact, but it won't, like, you know, you're not going to set coyote spirit on the mythos problem. Mm-hmm. But it will appear in some ways to guide really lost player groups. And there's people who were like, oh, that's mixing mythologies, and I hate that. Well, there's always going to be somebody who's going to hate everything or something. You know, I mean, you know, the idea that, these are non-mythos things, and that's a violation of Lovecraft. Okay, well, you know, what do I get for a violation? How many years do I get for that violation? Is it a $100 fine? Is it 4 months in the county pokey for violating canon, you know? I'm not terribly concerned about that in a lot of ways, because I just think that, you know, don't get married to the canon. You got to know when it's time to dump it in order to move your story along and tell the story you want to tell, you know?
Just as Lovecraft did and all of the mythos writers. I mean, you've got plenty of add-ons, yeah.
The rulebook itself has vampires and zombies and ghosts that are non-mythos related, but they're right there in the book.
But you're failing to take into account that there's no end point for the capacity of the human mind to delude itself. And when people want to argue some fine point like that about their favorite genre, they're going to be capable of ignoring all kinds of things. There's plenty of, you know, the jumble that is the Lovecraft mythos. And, you know, you're going to have people who are going to argue, well, you shouldn't call it a mythos because that was just August Derleth, and he's a big poopy head, so we're not going to call it the mythos. And that just seems pointless to me.
It's a good this term.
It's a handy term, and I'm going to go ahead and use it. And besides, you know, Lovecraft's own term that shows up in his letters, where he referred to it as Yog-Sothothery.
That's not going to fly, I'm afraid.
Mythos is a whole lot easier to get across.
I don't think Yog-Sothothery would have made it past the marketing department.
No. You know?
And say what you like about old August, he may have been a crap writer and badly finished some of Lovecraft's stories and worked in a ridiculous, you know, how vampires don't sparkle? Well, Cthulhu doesn't sparkle either. And Derleth worked in some sparkly Cthulhu at some point in his story. You know, say what you like about the guy. He's one of the primary reasons that this got rescued from the dustbin of history. So yeah. I can't say too many bad things about him, you know. I'm sure Howard Carter had any number of bad personal habits, but he's still the guy who found Tut's tomb and, you know, turned Egyptology into the sort of into the rock star, you know, phenomenal status it had, that, you know, for the first half of the century. Mm-hmm. Even today. You know, so too bad. He was the guy there first, just with the mostest. So and Derleth did a good job of rescuing this stuff.
Yeah.
Certainly he doesn't have the warts on him that I'm sort of forgetting the guy who God, the writer who rescued so much of Robert E. Howard stuff and then had the gall to rewrite Bob Howard's stories so that they would agree with pastiches of Conan he had written.
I'm not going to remember.
We're are you talking?
Yeah, not Farnsworth.
Farnsworth? No. It's not Fritz Lieber. I can't remember. There's a fellow who was resurrected a lot of Conan back in the day. And when you're looking at old Conan novels, you'd have Frazetta covers on them. Those books from the 60s, those are books that were edited by this guy. And he sort of, you know, got in fairly well with the heirs of the estate and, you know, got access to the stuff, but did weird stuff like, you know, rewrote Conan stories so that Conan stories, that Howard's versions would be reverse engineered to match stuff that this guy had written as pastiches. And for years, those are the versions people had to put up with. It wasn't until recently that Robert E. Howard's stuff has started to be re-released in these sort of big trade paperbacks, you know, like the Bran McMoran collection and Book of Conan 1 and 2, where they've gone back and they've put the Howard stories back together with all their warts, because they also smoothed out some of the things that modern audiences might find offensive, particularly Howard's sort of, you know, casual racism, and, you know, stuff that had been edited out in the 60s so that they'd be more palatable. Mm. you know, that kind of, I don't know, literary vandalism, Derleth really never did any of that. Derleth didn't go back and rewrite Call of Cthulhu and then, you know, publish it through Arkham House, you know. Mm-hmm. Change so it matched some stuff he wrote. Yeah, so I really can't say too many bad things about the guy.
Are we I just wanted to pull up the name. Are we talking about L. Sprague de Camp?
Yeah, sadly we are.
Yeah,
okay. That's it.
Sadly we are. It is L. Sprague de Camp. And he's taken a lot of heat in the last decade and in the last years of his life before he passed away about being this, you know, sort of hack.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Particularly, there are a number of people who wrote Conan stories with him in the 60s and who ended up seeing not a dime when the Conan movie was made. And they, it turns out that the stories they wrote for L. Sprague de Camp are all, you know, the rights were tied up with him and they didn't get to see a dime of it. It was all work for hire. So he found this writer who, you know, he saw the potential in him and then, you know, mined it for all he could, you know, when the rights were a little blurry. And by rewriting the stories, he actually was able to claim copyright for stuff. The rewritten version becomes his copyright. Now, he also wrote a biography of Howard. I'm getting way off course here. You know, have you guys seen a film with Vincent D'Onofrio called?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. What's it called? The Whole Wide World.
Yes.
The Whole Wide World. Yes. Yeah. That is based off the book by the woman who the story revolves around.
She
wrote that in response to L. Sprague de Camp's biography of Robert Howard.
Oh, that I didn't know. That's fascinating.
Painted him as a sort of paranoid, dysfunctional loser.
Yeah.
You know, no one would have heard of except that L. Sprague de Camp came and rescued his crappy stories from obscurity.
Uh-huh.
And her response to that was to write this novel. I think it was called The One Who Walked Alone, or The One Who Walks Alone, which is her experience of having grown up and known Robert E. Howard. So anyways, moving right along, let's get back to your questions, and I'll stop trashing L. Sprague de Camp.
Well, he's dead and can't argue, so.
Yeah, that helps.
I wanted to ask you about the stretch goal, the APs that you've been doing. I wanted to ask how they're going, first of all.
Well, I'm sadly going to be canceling one after that's supposed to happen today at 10 a.m. because I'm just beat. I'm not going to be able to do it. But right now I've got all but two have started playing. There's three. There's a group of guys who are apparently State Department people.
Nice.
Overseas who are like, they were like the Seychelles Islands, and they have, they're not going to be able to get started until I think January. There's a group of Filipino programmers in Luzon, Philippines, and I'm like, hey, I got a scenario set in the Philippines, and they're like, we want Delta Green.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well.
But it's set during the Philippine, you know, the Philippine insurrection in 1907. No, we don't want that.
Yeah.
We want Delta Green. Okay.
So we live that.
Great man. Way to fact check some stuff, though.
Well, there's a bunch of Belgians. There's another team of guys from Belgium, and I'm like, hey, I got a scenario set in World War I in Louvain, Belgium, during the German occupation. How about that? And they're like, no, we want Delta Green.
Yeah. No.
Okay. I'll just throw this out there, Scott. Anytime you want to send me a World War I scenario, you go ahead and pass it my way. I've got a group already set up that's ready to die.
Yeah, okay. We're in no man's land right now. I'm on my third or fourth character. We've had like four sessions.
So it's been things like, so you're smoking a cigarette, make a luck check. You're blown into a fine red mist.
That's yeah, not pretty far much. Off.
I think it took 10 minutes before our first death. So, yeah.
The chat here went insane within the first 3 minutes, I believe.
Yeah. Yep. All those World War I scenarios that you put together, Scott, everything about, are you going to collect those maybe and put out just a World War I book?
John Crow has already made a bunch of scenarios as well. And the goal was to cover sort of lesser known parts of the war. I have a Zeppelin scenario that involves going out to Persia, where flying a Zeppelin from Bulgaria over the Black Sea to Iran, to Persia, because the Germans had a sort of unknown covert guerrilla war going on in Persia during World War I, kind of a German version of Lawrence of Arabia that was going on over there that no one's ever heard of. John wrote a scenario set in Cameroon because it was a German colony. So there's a scenario where you can fight in the African jungle and hills of Cameroon. One of the scenarios, I've written one scenario that's a no man's land, but it takes place in a tunneling company where you're tunneling
underneath
tunnel rats.
About 300 feet down, digging these tunnels under the German lines to plant it's like 1.7 million pounds of explosives. The British did this thing called the Messines Ridge Attack, where they, over the course of 18 months, buried 17 mines totaling 1 million, almost 2 million pounds. It's a little less than a kiloton of explosives under the German lines. And when they set it off, the idea was they'd blow the Germans out of the high ground. They'd move out of Ypres, out of the low country, and up into the high grounds and take it.
Right.
As part of a way to break through and, you know, win the war by Christmas, you know. And the reality of the story is that they took that ground, the Germans took it back. They couldn't hold it. The German counterattack drove them out after an 18-month preparation. But when they set those mines off, the Germans, their casualties were horrific. The number of missing, never found, no trace, not a boot, not a dog tag, was something like 10,000 guys. So an entire division went poof and was never heard from again. That's not counting the corpses that were generated.
That's not counting the guys that the trenches that just completely closed up with men still in them. I mean, it's horrific.
Closed trenches with heads sticking up.
Arms coming out of the ground.
Above the ground, because the trench slammed shut. Concrete bunkers were rung like church bells, and the concussion vibration killed everybody inside, just liquefied their insides, caused hemorrhages in their brains, and killed them dead.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of World War I for some sick, twisted reason.
Well, you get to play guys who are digging under the trenches to plant those explosives, living in the dark, and you're given new orders to dig a new tunnel. Some Mandarin or Bodkin up in headquarters wants you to dig a tunnel in another direction, and let's just say it goes poorly. I have that was recorded on RPI. The Zeppelin one's never been recorded, although it's been played a bunch of times. We have one set on I wrote one that was set on a U-boat in World War I because, I learned that in the Mediterranean, the greatest U-boat captain of all time, a guy sunk more tonnage than anyone else in either war, was a guy named Lothar Arnaud de la Perrier. And he was a German. And he was from a German with a French family name left over from the, you know,
from Alsace or somewhere.
Or something, yeah. And this guy sank more tonnage than any other ship captain, any other U-boat captain in history. And during the course of his career, he fired a grand total of like 7 torpedoes.
Huh.
He'd pull up. They would simply chase down merchant ships, point the deck gun at them, demand to board it. There'd be a boarding action. They'd row over, check the ship's papers, and if it was carrying war material, they'd just open the seacocks and let the thing flood, plant a few scuttling charges, and sink it like that, or they'd sink it with the deck gun.
Oh, man.
And so, like, World War I submarine, but with boarding actions.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
I can make a scenario out of that. No problem.
Yeah.
John's got another one that's set when you're evacuating the German Navy base at Tianjin. Oh, not Tianjin? Tsingtao, excuse me. You know the beer, Tsingtao?
Sure.
Tsingtao beer? Well, the reason that there's beer from Tsingtao is the Germans got a port out of it, kind of the German version of Hong Kong, you know, on the Chinese coast after the Boxer Rebellion. And the first thing the Germans built there before they built their Navy base was they built a brewery because German workers were going to have a beer ration.
How are they going to get their vitamins otherwise?
So you're playing the Germans in Tsingtao where the city's about to be evacuated because the Japanese, as allies of the British, are about to besiege the city, the port city of Tsingtao. And so you're getting out on the last ship in sort of a fall of Saigon, except it's, you know, except it's World War I. Frank Fry, who used to write a lot of stuff for Twilight 2000, submitted the Shadows of Louvain scenario where you play people doing a murder investigation in the city of Louvain, Belgium, under German occupation, where an American has been killed. And the Germans are opening the investigation to foreign observers because they're trying to clean up their image in the wake of the mass shootings and murder of Belgian citizens in the opening months of the war. The Germans shot tons of Belgian non-combatants as reprisals against snipers that more than likely never existed in the first place during the opening months of the war. And it was really part of a program of what they called Schrecklichkeit, or fearsomeness. The idea that if we act like total douchebags with no provocation, the population will be cowed and will not resist the occupation. The result, though, is that, you know, the Rape of Belgium, it was called, made world headlines, and it greatly undermined the Germans' position.
Yeah, galvanized the Allies, for sure, right? Yeah.
And the neutral countries as well. People stayed neutral who might have joined the Germans. And so you can play Americans or Belgians or Germans, but the Americans are pertinent because A, it's an American who's the victim of the murder. And B, future President Herbert Hoover was running something in Belgium called the Committee for the Relief of Belgium.
Oh, really?
Neutral organization that was there running all over Belgium, getting, you know, transport passes and things like that to bring relief supplies to the Belgians, which at first the Germans were all in favor of because it meant they didn't have to feed the Belgians themselves, and it relieved them of that logistical burden. But the problem was that the Americans who were in the program and all the neutrals who were involved very quickly, you know, would report back the conditions in Belgium and the Germans would look bad. And
yeah.
It sort of failed. So you're in this moment, you guys appear, and the characters in that story appear right at the moment, just before the change in policy, where the Germans are still trying to put their best face on their rather shitty behavior in Belgium. And, you know, show, look, we didn't kill this American. We're sure we didn't kill. You can't put this on us. And you get there, and sure enough, his cause of death is something that, you know, clearly the Germans were not involved. I'll put it that way. And you then get to follow the train of supernatural evidence to something extra horrible. But the cool thing about Louvain is, and the part that, you know, ensures that it's going to be a horrible supernatural scenario is, Louvain, prior to the Germans burning it, most of it down, they sort of systematically burned sections of the city to make it uninhabitable. It contained one of the greatest medieval libraries in all the world. A huge collection, like 15,000 unique medieval manuscripts that were destroyed when the Germans burned the library. So,
maybe destroyed.
Yeah. I'm sure it was all destroyed. I'm sure
that's
it was all
great.
Gone. It's all gone. So this won't have – the scenario, of course, will have nothing to do with the contents of the library. I can guarantee you that much. So when I read that, library full of manuscripts and the Germans burned it down, maybe they had a good reason. Yeah. Maybe they were doing us a favor this time, you know? But, those are sort of the list of things that we've got that are set in stone. John Crow's got something he wants to do. Oh, my favorite one. Okay. One of my favorite things that John did was a scenario where you play Serbian soldiers. And one of the things that happened in World War I is that all of Serbia got overrun.
Right.
The Austro-Hungarians, sometime in 1915, got their shit together and just pummeled Serbia like cheap veal. Serbia is completely overrun. And the Serbian army and tens of thousands of refugees marched through neutral – that is the whole army, 100,000 guys, marched into neutral Albania. You know, and the Albanians just weren't in a position to stop them. And they marched through Albania just sort of like clearing out everyone's chicken coops as they went to feed themselves and went down to the coast of Albania where they got picked up by the Royal Navy and were evacuated. They were evacuated at first to Corfu, which was a British possession at the time, but they also got distributed to a lot of Greek islands all through the Aegean and dispersed. And there's this period of time where Greece doesn't want to be in the war, but these British troops show up and, you know, they want to march through Greece to get to a front and open a southern front. And there's a change in the government and the British arrange a coup. And then suddenly the king deposes the prime minister. And it's really just a mess. And finally, the word is up that they're going to take all these dispersed Serbian soldiers who've been cooling their heels on these Greek islands, eating tinned British meat, for the better part of 6 months. You're supposed to go and start gathering up your troops to bring them back so that they can be reformed into brigades and units and then re-equipped by the British and taken to Thessalonica to open a southern front where the Serbian army, equipped from the ground up by the British, will be fighting back in the war, fighting or whatever's left of it. And so the scenario starts off where you're playing these Serbian soldiers who are going to be, getting in a motor launch and going out to some isolated islands and checking to see if there are any Serbians there, anybody who got lost or got separated from their units, and try to police them up and bring them back into the fold. And that scenario, that setting where you're again, playing these Slavs who are marooned in these Greek islands, and, you know, it's all great that you use Cyrillic letters, but it's still not the same language. And you get out there, and then you face the supernatural threat that's on one of these islands. It was amazing. It was an amazing scenario. He went and found a folklore problem that I was unaware of.
Huh.
And this folklore problem was sort of indigenous to the area. And how do I put it? The two things you're not supposed to do, it's a mythological creature that goes door to door knocking.
Oh.
And if you respond in any way, if you speak to it, tell it to go away, you know, if you address it directly, suddenly they can gain access. The locks unlock magically. The boards that you've got nailed over the windows, the nails shoot out and the boards fall to the ground. The giant pile of stuff against the door just moves out of the way, like it's on ice skates. And if you don't engage with it, it'll just go to the next house, until it finds somebody stupid enough to talk to it. And then the doors fly open, the windows fly open, and it gets you. And that way, and the only thing that slowed them down was loud noises.
Huh.
So people would fire a gun or blow a whistle or, you know, things like that. There's a lot of stuff in spirit lore about, you know, you make a loud noise, you bang cymbals, you do fireworks.
Right.
You know, the Chinese do that to scare away bad spirits. Yep. And so at some point in the scenario, we found ourselves besieged in a lighthouse on the island. And one of my stupid co-players, you know, fucking had to taunt the bad guys. Fuck you, suck my dick, you miserable undead bastards, you know, or whatever. And we're all like, no, don't, you know, and he does, and boom, all of our barricades just fall over, and they're up to our hips, it just all pours in like water through breaches in the side of the Titanic, right? And we're being chased up the, we're just running up the interior staircase of the the lighthouse, and it's just like, they're gunshots, you know, we try to shoot our guns, and they're pulling the guns out of our hands and throwing them out the windows, and you know, they're all over us. And I get to the top of the lighthouse. There's no place to run. And I'm thinking, well, if I do a Luganus off the side of the lighthouse and hit the ground head first, maybe I'll die so they can't eat me alive, right? And then I'm right about to do, and then suddenly it just hit me like a thunderbolt. Holy gods, we're in a lighthouse. There's a foghorn.
Right.
And it's just that, you know, they're coming up, they're prying the hatch open, they're pouring in, and it's like, make a dex roll to see if you can get to the horn control, you know. That sort of slow motion dive through the air. how's your Greek? I don't read Greek. Well, make a mechanic roll to see if you can figure out how to work it. You know, 01. Thank you. Push the lever. You know, and all the horrible creatures flee out the windows. I don't mean they like jump out the windows. I mean, like, when that sound went off, it was like they all had like a harness attached to the back of them that was attached to a pickup truck that had already taken off. And had spooled out the cord so that, you know, when they get jerked out the entrances, they're jerked out at speed. You know, just boom, they just fly off into the darkness. And it was just like, could that have been closer? Oh, my God. You know, oh, my God. Yeah, and of course it was Blair Reynolds who had to taunt the monster. After we were told, don't taunt the monster. You know, good God, that guy. He has a special talent. He really does.
He's the scenario breaker that I've heard about, right?
Yeah, he has broken a few scenarios. He ate the clues in Shadows of Louvain. That was amazing.
right. I remember that on
Inspiration. Wait, what?
He ate the clues. There was a journal. All right, he's playing an American who's been brought in by the Germans to consult on this. He gets some time alone with the victim's journal. He starts reading through it. And I tell him some information, and he suddenly says, all right, I take that page, I tear it out of the journal, and I eat it. And I'm like, you realize you're in the German provost marshal's office surrounded by Germans. Yeah, I know that. Are you going to try and hide it? You know, how are you going to do this? It's just, it's like the bullpen at Barney Miller. You know, it's just a bunch of desks in this room. And he's like, I just pull it out and eat it. This the Germans, you know, don't quite get what's happening on the first page, but on the second page, you're like, you know, was ist los? Nein, das ist nicht richtig. And they jump up and
halt.
You know, halten Sie mit der Essen. You know, nicht essen der Buch. You know, so that's my terrible thing.
That was very good.
But, you know, and which then proceeds to, I say, they run over to grab you and wrestle the book away. And he's like, I get up and run. And so then the Benny Hill music starts. Yeah. And he's running around the office trying to eat the book and then throws it out a window, you know, and then the scenario was over because the Germans are infuriated. The other player character was not there. He gets back and finds out that the Germans are in the process of pouring Ipecac down, you know, the other player's and choking him with a long wooden spoon. He's like, what the hell's going on here? He's eating the evidence. You know, what kind of Verdammten, you know, treachery is this? And You know, it's like, okay, I guess we're getting kicked out of the country now. You know, your passport's revoked. Get out. So I'm like, scenario's over. I don't know how we come back from that. Scenario's over. I'm going to try playtesting this on somebody else.
And that was yet another purist anecdote from Adam Spacklancy.
I don't know if that's purist. That seemed a bit vaudeville to me.
Nobody's shooting with two guns, so.
Well, plenty of people are. You know, we've had plenty of shooting with two guns. We've had plenty of scenarios that came down where we were counting bullets, you know. Yeah. I guess if it's pulp, you never have to count the bullets.
That's the thing.
So that's the thing, yeah.
I'm sorry. It's not a siege. It's not a pulse-pounding siege unless you're counting the bullets. It's got to be like it's got to be Assault on Precinct 13, you know?
Right.
And I mean
right.
The original, not the crappy remake.
Right. That's one thing I have to say about No Man's Land is that most of the guys just didn't have the option to live long enough to have to worry about counting bullets.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we always had regenerating ammo when we just brought in a new character. And then they just scavenge ammo from the guy that just died.
Yeah. And it sounds like we've got to get this stuff into the hands of Murph and run this and promo it when it comes out, because it sounds like a fantastic
book. The idea is that we wanted to do a series of books. We got two books that are undone right now. One is a Mysteries of the Old West. That is, we've got a bunch of scenarios that are Wild West related.
Oh, cool.
And I'm
pretty, awesome.
Let me assure you that when you're playing a scenario where your gun is cap and ball ammunition, loading is a week, you know, you take your time and pick your moment before you start some shit. When you've got, you know, a black powder cap and ball revolver, because it's six shots and done, you know. You suddenly you're the outlaw Josie Wales, where you just carry, you know, nine damn
eight.
Pistols.
On, yeah, exactly.
You know, because otherwise, yeah, it's going to go badly. And it has for us. It's gone very badly several times playing in the Wild West. But that's Mysteries of the Old West. And the next thing we want to do is somewhere in there is Horrors of War, which is all these World War One scenarios.
Fantastic.
And we're going to include a fair amount of source material as far as how to convert, you know, World War One weapons tables and things like that.
Great.
And World War One gear. But I think what we're going to do is leave out we're not going to pack a source book with maybe a timeline, but no, we don't want to pack the source book too much anymore because it's not the 1990s anymore.
Yeah, you got that stuff in a Google machine.
Yeah. You've got this thing that will spit out those searches for you very easily. So the source material will be sort of, you know, I believe the source material needs to be per scenario. So if you've got a scenario set in Africa during the Great War,
mm-hmm.
Right.
You write that scenario. Or if you've got something set, you know, like in Tsing Tao, you write that source material right there. And you build it into the scenario rather than create a source book section. The only thing that we want to do in our source book is to try and explain to people that World War One isn't just the trenches. That it is the critical front. It's the front that decides the war. But
it was a world war. I mean, there was other aspects of it.
This thing does extend to Africa, Asia, you know, hell, there's a mutiny amongst the Indian troops in Singapore, in British-held Singapore, during World War One. There's a mutiny, which the Germans were always trying to get the various colonies of the Allies, because the Germans didn't have any colonies we're speaking of, but the British had India, the Russians had Central Asia, the French had North Africa, and one of the German goals was always to try and get their Turkish allies to inflame the Muslim world and cause trouble in their enemies' backyards. And the Russians, the Central Asian republics were all, you know, or provinces were all Muslim, and North Africa is all Muslim, and India and Pakistan have huge Muslim populations. And they did sort of, and they tried the same thing with the Irish to know. That didn't work either. But one of the bits that does happen is that there's a sort of spontaneous mutiny out in Singapore that was apparently a big enough a deal. I know very little about it, but, you know, the two or three lines I get in the history book is, oh, yeah, and the Russian and Japanese navies showed up to put it down. So foreign troops show up to gun down all the British mutinying British troops in Singapore and take the city back under control. And I'm like, well, that sounds like an astounding clusterfuck to have a scenario taking place during.
So it's right in the Bund, right in the on the waterfront. That's great.
Yeah, and the idea, it'd be the same thing as like having a scenario, you know, on the Titanic, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not even, the scenario doesn't cause the boat to sink. The boat's sinking on its own.
Yeah.
You know, you just happen to be on it and there's a problem. Well, in the hour and however many minutes it takes for the ship to go down, mm-hmm. you know, you've got another problem.
There's an extra problem, a really big problem. Yeah.
Where the merciful embrace of the icy North Atlantic will be relief. But we want to try and make sure people understand that this was a world war, that there's that horrible Alpine front, you know, down in Italy, right. Where they're having trench warfare, but on mountains. So
right.
It's vertical and snowing. It's great. And
snowing. Yeah. It's great.
Well thought out. Yeah.
It's got everything you could possibly want from trench warfare. But there's parts of the war that, you know, no one ever hears about, like that the Germans overran the state of Romania in about a month in 1916. If I remember correctly, the sister of the king, the king's wife of the queen of Romania is one of Queen Victoria's daughters, because Jesus, you know, everybody's right. Damn related. And she finally bullies her husband into joining the Allies. And the result is that Romania is overrun in a month. But you've still got this situation where, all right, you're telling me there's a war in World War One that takes place within Iraq's throw of Transylvania.
Mm-hmm. Magyar, you know, territory.
I'm sure I can come up with something there in Transylvania to ruin everyone's day, you know. Some of the creepiest parts of the world get tromped over during this war. Deepest, darkest Africa and, you know, huge swaths of the Pacific, too, are involved, at least early in the war. And so there's all these great options for corners of the world you never would have imagined that this stuff would have gone on in. One of the scenarios that John Crow did set us in Baghdad, where you are part of the British troops who have taken Baghdad away from the Turks, and you are working in the provost marshal's office of the Baghdad military police, right? I'm trying to remember. Oh, yeah. The weird little historical note in that was that your boss, your captain, who's in charge of the city, is Victor McLaughlin, the actor, who's later going to be the bad guy in movies like The Quiet Man or John Ford's The Informer, or he's going to play opposite John Wayne in about 50 damn movies, like She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. But before he goes on to acting and before he becomes a heavyweight boxing champion, actually maybe he was the boxing champion before because he got beat by Jack Johnson, who was a pre-war black boxer. But yeah, Academy Award winner Victor McLaughlin's your boss in that scenario. That was a very cool scenario because it drops you. When we were running it, we ran it the first time. We're in Baghdad, and it was right when we were doing that. We're going to be greeted as liberators. It's going to be awesome. Everyone's going to. You know, and here we are in Baghdad when the British were doing it, and I'm going to point out that the British did a better job than we did of keeping that place together. Even more dumb, Baghdad has been liberated three times this century. Once when the British took it away from the Ottoman Turks, once when the British took it away from a fascist coup in 1940, which was about to declare for the Nazis. And then, you know, once when we strolled in 2004, I guess it was.
Three.
And every single time that city has been, you know, liberated, the locals have looted it. It's turned into a loot fest every single time. So the idea that, well, this couldn't have been predicted.
Except for two really awesome case studies.
Every other time.
Except for two really awesome case studies.
Yeah, except for those two times. And I will say this: the British did a much better job keeping order with Indian cavalry with lances. Apparently, having a Hindu mounted on a horse with a long spear tends to take all the fight out of the local Muslims. I don't. I think that was probably the locals' worst case scenario would be to have infidels like that turn up, you know, with infield rifles and Vickers machine guns.
Not even Abrahamic, yeah.
No, yeah, exactly. You know, exactly. Not even people of the book. Oh, darn. We got to run around Baghdad in 1918, and it was that was a very, very cool scenario.
Nice.
So
now, when is this thing expected? Are we looking at next year or far-flung future?
I have to get artists. I have to get – yeah, it depends. I mean, yeah, I could run a Kickstarter for it, but I'm uncomfortable doing that. I'm going to run a Kickstarter, and I'm going to get, you know, Delta Green Targets of Opportunity done as a soft cover paperback. That's going to answer. But I'm uncomfortable doing either of these things until I've got some more artwork contracted for them and I do some layout, because I don't want to set up a situation like Murph's going through where, you know, he contributed and then however months later, you know, where's the book?
Yeah,
you
know? Right.
If I sure these scenarios have been written and play tested, but they're not in publishable form. Mm-hmm. The close, I mean, one, there's two of them that are sort of in publishable form. The Zeppelin scenario and the airplane scenario that takes place over the Italian Alps. Both of those are very close to being in publishable form. And I may, you know, spend some money and get those illustrated and laid out. And then try and use those as sort of a promo item for the whole book. Like if you do the Kickstarter, then you get this stuff as your PDF, you know. And yes, it'll all show up in the book later, or maybe it's a special thing you only get with the Kickstarter, you know, something like that. But I would need to have the books far further along than they are now. I mean, if I was just maybe I'd ask for a Kickstarter I'd go do a Kickstarter if we were starting to lay it out.
Yeah.
But that would be it. It would need to be edited. It would need to be, we really need to have had it edited, and collected the art, for it before I would really feel comfortable with that. Because I don't like
any chance of you just sending me one of those World War I scenarios?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you do what everybody else does on RPPR, and when we played them at Gen Con, people would just take notes on the damn game and then just inflict it on their players based on the notes that they picked up from it, to varying degrees of, you know, degrees of effectiveness.
Yeah, we can do that.
But I'm gonna keep that close at hand, because it might actually be worth something.
Right.
It might very well be worth something. We're falling behind. I mean, we started doing these World War I material like 4 years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
Just started writing it back then. And, you know, Bumps in the Night is a project that was written probably close to, I think the last thing was written for it 6 years ago.
Oh, wow. That gives you a good sense of how long these arcs are for production.
Yeah, sometimes. Kickstarter has definitely given an option for, you know, being able to open up opportunities for these stuff. You know, if I was to put this stuff up there and say, you know, okay, who wants to contribute to this? And we got a huge number, then, well, DG, I guess that's the book we're going to make, you know?
Yeah.
If somebody threw, you know, between artist fees and printing, a book like Delta Green was like a $20,000 for all the art, all the writing, all the editing, all the proofreading, all the printing and shipping. That's like a $20,000 to $25,000 project. Delta Green Countdown was like $30,000 we had to spend printing and shipping and art and everything else. Wow. So the money it costs, and, you know, that's why, frankly, Goodman Games has got the right idea doing smaller projects. The only problem with their what they're doing is something we ran into with Final Flight. We published a very small book called Final Flight a while back, a single standalone scenario. And the problem with it was so short, it was staple bound. And the result is, if it's sitting on a shelf at a bookstore, spine out, you can't tell what the product is.
There's no title
on it.
Yeah, you just have that crease there, and that's it.
That's really tough for marketing. You really need to go 64 pages for a project so that the customer can always see it on the shelves. I'm sorry to say, these are the kind of crap we have to consider when we're putting something out. Certainly, you know, the options exist for, you know, publishing these. Some of the stuff could, you know, could end up being published as print on demand and PDF only. Certainly a lot of companies have gone that way. I think White Wolf is seeing that way exclusively now.
Yeah, I think that's the only way that they produce now.
Because there's just, you know, it costs to send that, you know, hunk of dead tree around the world. And those dirty bastards at Lightning Print, when they're doing print on demand, one of the things we found out through one bookshelf is that they have a printer in London and they have a printer in Australia. So they can just put the book in the teleporter and teleport it across the Atlantic or Pacific to meet markets in Asia and Europe. And that shaves $18 off your shipping costs.
Oh, wow.
We're sending a book across the Atlantic, priority mail. Oh, you know, nice. Suddenly the customer can order it and they don't have to pay. Because we get a lot of whinging. We get a lot of whinging about the cost of sending stuff over the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Scott, I'd love to keep going, but we're running out of time.
I imagine you ran out of time a long time ago. And I apologize for running my mouth about things that weren't necessarily what you wanted to talk about.
That's why we let you run
it. It's all good, man.
Stop talking. Just stop talking. Let us talk out or we scold you, but you have to stop talking.
Another cool scenario. Stop, please. I can't stand it.
Is there any other question you want to finish up with? And that's burning a hole in your pocket, and I'll try and keep it under 5 minutes.
I don't have anything else. I think
we didn't cover bumps quite as much as we wanted to, but we'll definitely suggest it.
one of the things about bumps that really I wanted to point out that worked out really well for the Kickstarter. One of our stretch goals was, gee, if we get over X thousand dollars, we'll send you out a PDF of the playtest notes.
Cool.
What happened in the game, which included some of the things like Blair getting shot in the chest and thinking he was dying and charging into the cultist like a madman because he thought he had 3 combat rounds to live and he wanted to make sure he died with an empty shotgun in his hands surrounded by a pile of dead cultists. that thing with the playtest notes, I actually got a lot of feedback about that. People really enjoyed hearing how the scenarios did or did not work out for us. I'm hoping that when we do Mysteries of the Old West and Horrors of War, we'll definitely be including the playtest notes, which includes things like the desperate dive for the foghorn on the lighthouse. That scenario got to be, I don't know if you guys are familiar with old time radio, but that's I really love that scenario because it reminded me of this old. It's an old Vincent Price radio play called Three Skeleton Key.
Ooh.
Where they play these guys tending a lighthouse off the coast of French Guiana, these ex-Devil's Island prisoners who are serving what they call their doublage, which is you do X number of years in the prison, and then you're released and you're forced to live in French Guiana for a time equal to your time as a prisoner before you're allowed to go back to France. So they're in this tiny lighthouse that, you know, when the high tide comes in, the island it's on disappears, just sticks up out of the ocean. And a ship comes in and wrecks. A sailing vessel appears one night and wrecks on their reef. And there's this great moment where they're looking through their binoculars going, why is the ship blurry? The ship looks blurry. And as it gets closer and then like the light from the lighthouse passes over it, they realize that the reason the ship is blurry is that every inch of the ship that's above water is swarming with a giant living carpet of rats.
Nice.
Oh, gross. That have been doing nothing but fucking and eating each other for who knows how long, and the ship crashes and breaks up on the rocks, and this giant carpet of rats comes swimming across the water and starts climbing up the sides of the lighthouse and chewing its way in through the window frames, and oh my god.
Yeah, I'm going to have to listen to that one.
It's available online. You can find it in Three Skeleton Key.
It's going to be linked in the show notes.
Oh, fantastic. I was just looking, too.
It is. It smells like a Call of Cthulhu scenario. It really does. It's
brilliant.
Awesome. It's just a brutal, brutal scenario. Nice. And being trapped in the lighthouse was a lot like that.
Great.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us. We know we really appreciated you coming.
I'm glad to finally catch up to you guys and promote our products, buy our books. Go to Arkham Bazaar and buy a copy of Bumps in the Night, please. Or buy our books off of Drive-Thru RPG. It's filled with horrible things you can do to your players. They'll hate you for it.
It's even better.
Totally sold. Right on.
All right, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Scott. Have a good one.
I will do my best.
All right.
All right. Keep us updated about new products.
We will. We will. Cool. We will definitely be feeding you new books to review as soon as we have a new book.
Fantastic. Wonderful.
All right. Thank you so very much, sir.
All right. Good morning to you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Right. See you around the campus. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
We want to hear from our listeners, and we have several methods to get in touch with us.
Our main contact email address is feedback@mu-podcast.com. We also have a Twitter account, @mu_podcast.
We've got our Providence, Rhode Island voicemail number at 401-400-0MUP. That's 401-400-0687. Feel free to ask us a question, or you could even just leave us a liner saying, I'm enrolled at the Miskatonic University Podcast, and give us a hearty Go Pods for our home team, the Fighting Cephalopods.
Our website is www.mu-podcast.com, and you can find our show notes for this episode at mu-podcast.com/20.
And our 24/7 streaming content is at mu-podcast.com/radio, and you can listen to individual show segments over there.
Our forums are over at mu-podcast.com/campus. And we've also got a thread over on the Yog-Sothoth forums in the Mythophonia section, so you can join us over there as well.
And please sign up for our show on iTunes, or you can use the RSS feed found on the website. The IRC channel is still up and running. Come by and say hello there. Also, we'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode and hopefully many episodes to come, audible.com.
And we're also on Stitcher Radio, so if you use that, you can stream our shows wherever you happen to be. Thank you all for joining us for another episode, our longest one yet, most likely. Thank you much. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.